Welcome to the DL.
It's Monday morning. The Big East is in the national championship twice, right? Isn't Big East basketball back?
Did it go anywhere? It was the same as last year. They got one team in the Final Four, but this team decided to win this year. And hey, it could be a heck of a game tonight, you know? I'm excited for it.
No, but don't they have two teams in the Final Four? Because didn't Notre Dame beat Connecticut?
Yeah, right.
Oh, no, all right, we're going to stick to that. By the way, huge upset. That the men's, who would have thunk a month ago? How great is college basketball? Who would have thunk a month ago that the women's Connecticut team won't get to the championship game, but the men's Connecticut team will?
Oh, well, ESPN thought I needed this news, you know, at 11:45 last night and kept texting me about it, which is really obnoxious. I do have my text set. Don't spend past midnight. Well, it's like, update, UConn might lose. Update, UConn lost. It's like, dude, seriously, can I put non-women's sports in that thing as well?
You know what I might, you know what I might blame this on? Logistics. I hate those logistics ads. The one great thing about the NCAA tournament finishing tonight, much like when the NFL season ended and we no longer had to watch those terrible Coors Light press conference commercials because Coors Light lost the NFL contract, and hopefully they'll think of another marketing campaign. This is the last day of logistics. Now, I don't know if it's been on TV as much as it's been online, but when you watch these games on March Madness on demand, you get like six commercials. They keep the same, you know, three clients on online, and then they just rotate their commercials. I have seen that UPS logistics commercial probably 50,000 times in the last month, and I want to punch every coach in the world.
Is that online? It's just funny because I did not wind up watching anything online. I just don't even know commercials at this point. I watch everything on DVR. I switch channels when things come on, I was in front of a TV, I guess, most of the time for this.
Yeah, Gino Auriemma is one of the guys saying, you know, everybody cheers when the ball goes into the net, but nobody cheers when the pass and this and that and the movement. You know what that all is? Logistics. Basically, what happened with the logistics ad is and having done this, having worked on some campaigns, not advertising campaigns for commercials necessarily, but you and I know enough about this, and we have friends in the business. And we watch Mad Men. I mean, come on, let's be honest. You can see through commercials now. You can see right through. This was some ad executive saying to a VP at UPS, "What do you guys do?" And they say, "Well, we ship. We do that." But what does that all mean? And then somebody just looks at them and goes, "I'm doing like jazz hands when I say this. Logistics." And they convinced somebody at UPS to be like, oh, my God, that's the greatest thing ever. And now they've just jammed it down our throats. So God bless you, NCAA tournament. I no longer have to care about logistics.
Yeah.
That's my rant for the day. Let's talk a little bit about the game. It's not David versus Goliath. It's sort of great story versus great story. Because as much as you hate Jim Calhoun, and I think everyone's grown to hate Jim Calhoun at this point, and people are joking all week, oh, we have to root for Butler because if Connecticut wins, another title will be vacated within the next 5 years. But if you think about it, except for the fact that it's Connecticut, and we're all supposed to hate Connecticut, it's a great story. This team was in the middle of the pack. People thought 2 months ago they might even make the tournament if the Big East didn't get 11 teams. They finished ninth place in the Big East, and they go on this epic run in the Big East tournament. And then they continue it in the NCAA tournament, and everyone's looking around saying, I mean, Lamb came into his own, but this was one player who just carried a team on his back until everybody else showed up with him, and now they're in the championship game. So we'll start with that. I mean, this is – taking the name on the jersey out of it, this is a great story.
Oh, sure, it's a great story. It's so interesting to watch with a team that is undefeated on neutral floors, if I'm not mistaken, undefeated out of conference.
Right, which says something about the Big East, by the way.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. Like, okay, we joke around about, you know, only one team made a Final Four, whatever. I mean, they're the best. They don't have the best teams per se, but top to bottom, they're the best conference. And so when you go through that, you know, you're going to learn something about yourself. Now, the other teams didn't seem to learn a heck of a lot because they got bounced pretty early. But UConn really seemed to toughen up. And listen, they're getting it done in the tournament. And that's what it's about. All four of the teams that were left were teams that were not necessarily picked to be in the Final Four. But when the light went on, they did their job. And that's all, you know, and that's what you're supposed to do in this tournament. Unfortunately, now, the effect of this is the drum is sounding about, well, maybe the BCS is right. I mean, look, the regular season means nothing. And these teams just go there and we have to stop it. Seriously, stop it. Well, if the teams win and they won, I mean, yes, you could, an argument can be made about whether or not what the regular season means per se, and that the top teams aren't there. But if you're the top team, you got to win when you're a favorite. You got to win on a neutral floor. You can't lose to these 11 and 12 seeds.
2 years ago, 4-1 seeds went to the finals. So, I mean, it's a crapshoot. It's a roll of the dice. But I think what this does, and I thought about it a lot over the weekend, I think what the NCAA tournament does, and especially a Cinderella situation like this where an 11 seed and an 8 seed get to the Final Four, it galvanizes whichever way you feel. If you're a guy who feels the NCAA tournament is the greatest sporting event of the year, anybody can win, you know, when it's a one-game series, upsets happen, chaos is great. This has galvanized that. This has made you believe even more strongly about the concept of the NCAA tournament. If you're a BCS guy, if you were the best team should always win the national championship, not a team that gets lucky and wins 5 or 6 games, then this tournament has galvanized that thought too. Because you look at the top teams and say, well, VCU and Butler, they wouldn't have been in the BCS. And people who like that model, maybe not the actual BCS, but the fact that 4 teams should decide. You know, we're going to compare in a couple of weeks. Well, we won't, but you know, somebody will in a couple of weeks. Major League Baseball's playoff structure and the NBA. The NBA is going to have at least one team under 500. MLS had a team that had an under 500 record win their title a couple years ago. That's not great for pro sports, but it's different in college. And I think that that's why we love the NCAA tournament, because it does give everyone a chance. It does get VCU equal ground, although they had to play one extra game, to everyone else. It does make Shaka Smart the hottest name on the planet, even though he's really never recruited anyone that's done anything, because he's only been there 2 years. He's going to get any job that's open that he wants. NC State, I think, is the hot rumor. But all he's done is, I mean, not all he's done. He's made a great run. But he hasn't even, there weren't even his recruits. So it makes stars out of people. And that's what's great about this tournament. We just sort of throw everything else out the window and say, hey, neat.
I just feel if you should be more inclusive than exclusive in trying to determine a championship. And I'm not saying inclusive to the point, like you said, with NBA where, yeah, sub 500 team. And listen, it's the rule. It's the same thing, you know, football this year. People are freaking out about the Seahawks. Oh, my God, sure, how could they possibly even be allowed in the playoffs? Well, those are the rules that are set up. And when they got there, they won. So shame on the Saints for losing to a team that no one thought should be there. And shame for Kansas, you know, for losing to VCU. If you're upset, well, guess what? You had your chance to prove it. And that's all we've argued the whole time on the BCS. And in BCS, we're talking about teams either have one loss or no losses. We're not trying to get, you know, an 8-4 team the championship. No, we're not saying they deserve to be there. Although,
unless they're in the Big East.
I was going to say, some of those Big East teams could have made a run. You know, and that would, and they would have deserved to win had they won in that situation. But all we were saying the whole time during the college football season is, give the teams that have earned it a chance, and you don't earn it, really. I mean, you don't have the chance, I guess, to earn it in NCAA, is what we're saying, is that you have to just be one or two teams. And in the case of NCAA, yeah, we had a team that made this run with VCU, and that's a rarity. Like, 2 years ago, as you said, 4 number one teams make it. But the bottom line is they play these games on the court, and we're watching it. And you know what? People are watching it. So the ratings are great. So people do seem to enjoy the fact that you have to win on the court to win the championship here. And I think the BCS would, I just think the ratings would be phenomenal.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah.
We all know that.
It does strike a balance, though. While I do think this galvanizes the BCS people, I think that they would have to admit that opening it up to a 8-team tournament would be so much better than just picking 2 teams. Because I think you could still say, look at the top 1 and 2 seeds in the college basketball. If you just took them, it still would have been a great tournament. It wouldn't be as epic. It wouldn't be as memorable as a VCU run like this. Or Butler, who we haven't even talked about yet. The Butler Bulldogs are in the national championship game for the 2nd year in a row. I mean, it's the most incredible thing I can think of in college sports. I mean, VCU, and we said this before the Final Four, VCU took their Cinderella Thunder away. If that VCU team, now maybe if VCU were Kansas or whoever, Butler wouldn't be in the title game, but they've beaten everyone they've played. They beat a 1 seed already. So, I'm not saying anyone's underplaying the Butler story because it's huge, but it's almost like we've taken them for granted. Somebody tweeted after the game, well, VCU lost, so there goes the ratings for Monday night. Because nobody's going to care about Butler because they've already been there, but everyone would pay attention to VCU. I completely and wholeheartedly disagree. Because we like to watch players we know. And as much as we like the Cinderella, last year's Cinderella, Duke against a team you've never heard of. You can't get better than that, especially a last-second shot in the air for like 15 seconds, rims out. That team is the one that got back. That makes me want to watch tonight. No offense to VCU, and that's a great story, but I was more interested to see if Butler can actually get back and win this year. So I think that the ratings should be better than if it were VCU. Do you? What are your thoughts?
Oh, no, I agree with that because I think in some ways they, while they are an underdog in that they're an eight seed, they legitimize the game in that, well, this team's been there before and they have unfinished business. And I watched them play, you know, I watched the average person. I watched them play last year. And so I know that they can hang with the big boys. Obviously, and like I said, this year they've knocked off a one seed. They've made their way through against a team, you know, a coach that has two championships. So that's an even better story. You know, the VCU UConn story would have been great. It would have been, oh my God, can they finish it up? But this one, you know, this amazing run, and, you know, as an 11 seed. But with Butler, you have the team that you say, oh my, I think they can do this. And so you go into the game thinking, not like last year, well, oh, can they pull it off? No, you know they can pull it off. It's a matter of whether they have, you know, the fortitude to get through it. So it's, I think they were, would have been equally interesting games, but I don't think this diminishes the game in any way. I don't think people are, you know, they're settling. I think they know they've got a good game in their hands.
Right. And again, and I mean, no disrespect to VCU. It was a great run. Can you name one player today? I mean, maybe you can because you just watched the game 2 days ago, but in 15 minutes, are we going to be able to name those guys? I hope so, because they deserve it. And one of those, two of those guys might be NBA players eventually, but we seem to know everybody on this Butler team now. It's amazing what 14 games can do over the course of 2 years. You know, we know Matt Howard. You know, we know, you can tell by their faces. You could, I mean, these guys could walk down the street, Shelvin Mack, you could see him in a playground and be like, oh my God, that's the guy that played at Butler, which is really neat that this little engine that could became a household name. That, over the span of 2 years, is the best story in college basketball that I can remember.
I'm trying to think if I saw Shelvin Mack, if I'd recognize him. But I will pretend for this sake of argument, I would. No, you're right in that there is some familiarity with them. There's a familiarity with the coach. And the cool thing about this game is everyone kept talking, like you said, with Shaka Smart, is where's he going to get a job? Where's he going to get a job? And that was the talk, you know, last year with Butler. And now it's like, no, you know what? He's going to stay. You feel like, I know this guy's going to stay because he's built a program that is good. They can definitely attract recruits now. And so you're not going into thinking like, oh my God, if he wins a national title, what jobs are going to take? Like, you feel like this is his job. You feel like this is his team. And you sort of feel good about that. And you look at it, it's almost like, I don't know, looking at like, say, like Jerry Sloan in Utah. It's like, that's a great coach and it's sort of a smaller market, but he's there. And I mean, not anymore, but all throughout the championships. So yeah, I think that this game is as good as the other game. And I I'm looking forward to it. Maybe more so than other games in the past, because I don't know. I feel like the Cinderella, like you said, is not as much a Cinderella and they can win. And that's kind of why I want to watch.
By the way, I think you tripped yourself up over all the championships. I think in your head slowed down. You're like, wait a minute, did Utah win any championships?
No, not win. I meant going to. I knew they didn't win. There was something else in my head at that point. There's lots of stuff in my head.
By the way, to the point of Butler guys walking down the street and you recognize them, if you see Ronald Norred walking down the street, it might actually just be Jay-Z. If you look at Norred's face, he's behind one of the guys the other day shooting a free throw. He looks exactly like Jay-Z. It's incredible. I don't know if anybody's made a big enough deal about this, so I'm doing it right now.
You're going to bang the drum for it.
By the way, the thing is, I'm selfishly, and I'm no fan, although I used to be a fan of Joe Calhoun, but I'm no fan now. And as a Rutgers person, Connecticut, not my favorite team, trust me. But banging the Big East drum as loudly as we have, this is a great Final Four for me, personally. This is the Big East could win a title and validate the 11 teams in a way, or a great likable team with a great likable coach who was there last year and was you know, half an inch away from beating Duke, and they get their retribution. There's not a bad storyline in this if you're a Big East fan. If you're a regular college basketball fan, clearly you're rooting for Butler, and I would not begrudge anyone for doing so. But you can still, like we said, the team that just got hot late, came out of nowhere. This is a really good sort of storyline championship game, and I hope that the writers who are there, because there's 60 billion of them, figure out a good angle that's different from everyone else, because there are a lot of them.
The angles, if UConn wins, it'll be interesting to see, because I wonder if people have the guts to talk about the cloud. I mean, especially after last weekend with all the stuff that went down with Miles talking, and, you know, if they're going to say, well, this is great, but, you know, what's going to be coming in the future for everybody. You know, if Butler wins, I mean, the story just writes itself, I think, and it's not going to be a lot very different. You know, I don't think you're going to see a lot of different stories because, you know what, it should be celebrating the team. So just go for it. Just talk about how the little guy, you know, won. You know, make your Hoosiers reference if you want, whatever you want to do out of Indiana. But I'll be more interested to see how people frame the Connecticut win because it will be his third. And it is a team that, you know, certainly wasn't favored as the Big East, the big one coming out of the Big East. But there's so much controversy, and it really could affect them down the line.
So let's play a little prognostication before we get to some baseball stuff. And we have I want to talk about something Mark Cuban wrote. So we'll get to that in a second. But before we go, who do you think is going to win? And most importantly, what will the Nanceism be for that team?
The Butler, no. The Butler did it. No, I don't know. There's Cinderella, the slipper fits, something like that for them.
But he's done that, right? I mean, that's...
Probably. I mean, but yeah, but I mean, this is the, you know, or it's something about the ultimate Cinderella, or so, I don't know. With UConn, you're better at this than me. I have no idea what he's going to say for UConn.
UConn, I mean, it's so hard. Like, I think if Kemba Walker has a great tournament, he could say, you know, Connecticut, it's so cheesy if he says walks to the title, you know, because it's not Walker. I don't know. It could be Calhoun, third time's the sweet. It's really hard. This is a really hard sort of, and I'll think about it throughout the day. So if you follow me on Twitter, I'm sure I'll be tweeting out my thoughts on Nanceism. But you're right. I think Jim Nance is rooting for Butler. The Butler finally did it. The Butler, you could do the Cinderella thing. That's I can't wait for that. And Luther Vandross doing One Shining Moment. Those are two things I look forward to. Let's drop in a little bit of music. We will recap very quickly the first weekend in baseball because it looks like in some of these divisions it's already over, right? Boston stinks. We'll get to that in a second.
On the DL, isn't that about baseball?
So as I mentioned before the music, Boston, they're done, right? Texas swept them. Season's over. Pack it up, fellas.
Yeah, so much for my central pick. There's an 0-3 Milwaukee team after being blowing it in the ninth and then blowing it the rest of the weekend. I love the first weekend of baseball because people get way too high and they get way too low. And this is the ultimate grind. I mean, of all the sports, this is the ultimate grind. And yet, you'll see panic in the streets of Boston right now after the 0-3 start. And you know what? They'll rebound. They'll be fine. And the 3-0 Orioles wouldn't get too worked up about that either. Probably a good team. They've definitely played well last year. But, you know, let's not get too excited, everybody. And,
if the season ended today, Baltimore and Kansas City. Baltimore and Kansas City, Nick. By the way, Tampa Bay, and I don't want to sound alarmist, but Tampa Bay, 0-3, they got swept by the Orioles, and Evan Longoria just went on the DL. There is a little bit of time to panic. And the reason I say this, and it's not because they're not going to be a good team this year. It's because they have the Yankees and the Red Sox in their division, and clearly they just got swept by the Orioles. So that team could be competitive. And people think Toronto's going to be good, and they're 2-1 right now. It's a good division. Could Tampa Bay suddenly go from being a contender if Longoria has nagging injuries, if this is a foreshadowing sense of other guys could be getting hurt? And you can't – look, I mean, the stat heads are screaming right now. You can't take one injury from one guy and extrapolate it to every other member of the team. But sometimes teams get snake bit. And you wonder if a guy a game or two into the season goes on the DL. People are saying that in Philly, right? Oh, my God, look at all the injuries. Chase Utley and blah, blah, blah. And Polanco's arm might fall off. You used bubble gum as a term the other day. You look at Tampa and say, wow, every win matters in that division because that division is going to come down to a team with 93 wins might not make the playoffs because the other teams had 94 and 97. You know,
absolutely.
So this is a bad start for them.
Well, and like you said, you can't take one player out and, like you know, as a stat hit, you know, extrapolate it out and ruin the team. But there's a swagger you get from play. And he's the unquestionably, I mean, Crawford is gone and Bartlett is gone. And some of the pitchers are, you know, you take out the guys who are gone from that team.
Garza with the spitting and the glove work. Gotta hate that.
Yeah, but he's the marquee player on the team. And when you lose that guy, there is a confidence factor that you know, it doesn't show up on paper, but all of a sudden you get that bop right in your lineup and everyone doesn't feel as good. Now you start looking and saying, well, Manny and Johnny, what can you do for us? So, it doesn't look good. And in that division, you can't afford to lose. Still don't think you get too worked up about it, but I would be feeling worse as an 0-3 Tampa team than I would be as an 0-3 Boston team right now.
But there was a triple play in the Indians game?
There was, and it was a weird triple play because it was sort of like they looked a second and realized, oh, wait, we can throw it over there and get one too, the way it went down. It wasn't one of those bang, bang, bang. It was slow-moving ones.
It's pretty funny. I mean, if you watch this is what's great about baseball. If you watch the first game of the season where it looked like the Indians would not win a game, it was 11-0 White Sox in like a fifth inning. And then 2 days later, and it's still 1-2, but 2 days later they come back and they win 7-1. You know, the old say, what is that saying? That momentum is only as good as the next day's opening starter. And for the Phillies, that's Cole Hamels in game four of the season. Who's going to be the first Phillies pitcher to lose a game? Now, Roy Halladay was the losing pitcher of record until the Phillies had that miraculous comeback that you and I were both at. So the Phillies undefeated because of a ridiculous comeback in the ninth inning against Brandon Lyon, my new favorite closer for another team other than Jonathan Broxton. But who will be the first Phillies starter to catch a loss? Because he will get booed like crazy.
Oh, he won't get booed. People are in jovial mood right now. But you know what?
Nick, if it's Joe Blanton on Sports Talk Radio, I would not want to
let it be to the Mets, because that's the one that people will get upset. People will be upset. Like, how could you lose to the Mets?
I'm telling you, if Cole Hamels wins and Joe Blanton loses to the Mets, we will not hear the end. Do not listen to Sports Talk Radio that day. Oh, we should have traded that bum. Because Kendrick's so much better.
Housekeeping.
Let's do a little housekeeping now. I will ask you if you have anything else in a minute, but I have anything else first. Darren Revelle tweeted something early yesterday morning at like 7 a.m., and so I don't know if anybody saw it. On April 3rd at 2:30 a.m., Mark Cuban was sitting at his computer and wrote for Blog Maverick, "Does ESPN have a Twitter problem?" And he writes about how ESPN has always been sort of on the front end of things. There was Twitter and Facebook and blah, 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 and ESPN has been pushing their social media. They had that ESPN 140 where like they allow you to chat with them and it's sort of like their own Twitter and whatnot. But he, Cuban meaning, he is bringing up the point that Twitter and Facebook drive more traffic to websites than RSS feeds and just other ways. And we've talked about this quite a bit, that Twitter can be a very useful tool to get people to go to your site and read what you have. It's more of a portal than just a standalone news organization or news outlet. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice. This is the thing that I have an issue with Cuban. Quote, ESPN.com reporters haven't had a lot of success getting followers on Twitter. Some columnists like Bill Simmons have. The vast majority of the reporters have under 100,000 followers, and many of those, as best I can tell, have under 10,000. Which in a nutshell means the worldwide leader in sports doesn't have much in the way of muscle to drive traffic from Twitter users to their sites. That is a risk. And then the next three paragraphs talk about, can somebody else sneak in and start hiring people who have robust Twitter followers and use that as leverage to gain traffic for their sites, whether it be Yahoo or Fox or whatever. And has ESPN opened the door to allow other people? Now, Yahoo's beating them online anyway, so I don't know what Cuban's point is, but I looked at the numbers. And I tweeted with Revelle about this yesterday. I just think Cuban's not following the right people. Because he says, I'll go back to his point. Some columnists like Bill Simmons, right. The vast majority of the reporters have under 100,000 followers, and many of those, best I can tell, have under 10,000. Nick, you follow a lot of ESPN people. And I'll go through the numbers in a second, but who the hell is he following if he thinks the vast majority have under 10,000 followers?
Yeah, no, I don't know who he's looking at for that one, and if he's just maybe looking at, I don't know who he's. I have no idea who he's looking at. Here's the thing with Twitter. As far as ESPN goes, ESPN.com is a sports destination for many people. I mean, tons and tons and tons of people. So I don't think they need Twitter to push people to their site. People go to their site and they go to, you know, it's sort of independent. But also, as you know, people want information in short bursts in Twitter. So they want the crux of the story. And if they get that, then they may not want it going to the site. If they see so-and-so traded, they see that, and then later on they may go to the site, but they may not necessarily link to that. Now, people like Buster Olney often tease what's in their pay things, which I think a lot of people are like, well, I'm not going there because I'm not paying for it.
Right.
So they use it in different ways. But the bottom line is you're going through Twitter quickly, go, okay, I got my news from that guy, I got my news from that guy, I got my news from that guy. You're not necessarily always going there to sit down and go, okay, now I'm going to digest things that people have written through Twitter. I'm going to go read this whole article, then go back to Twitter and go read this whole article. So I don't know why – I think the site is doing fine. I don't think it matters if the Twitter people are pushing them.
But I still go back to the point of I don't think he's right. In this regard, maybe he's following because Cuban's an NBA guy. Maybe Cuban is following the NBA people. So let's start there. The NBA – now, what Darren Revelle said to me, and this is a direct message, but whatever. He said that Cuban was probably talking about the reporters. And to some extent, the reporters do not have huge followings. For example, Tim McMahon, who is the ESPN Dallas reporter has 5,692 people. That's in Cuban's market. So maybe that's who he's talking about, a regional writer. But if you go to the NBA reporters, Chris Broussard is probably their lead reporter. He's breaking all the Miami Heat news and whatnot. 112,941 followers as of the time I found it this morning. Rick Bucher, 81,900. Chad Ford, 71,000 plus. The NBA Twitter feed itself, NBA on ESPN, almost 55,000. John Hollinger, 40,000. Henry Abbott, there you go, now 25,000. You'd think he would have more. And Brian Windhorst, who went from Cleveland to Miami, sort of a regional blogger, if you will, has over 20,000. Those are just six or seven guys. If you go to the NFL, Adam Schefter has 529,000 followers. Trey Wingo is 415,000, whatever. Chris Mortensen, 281,000. Michael Smith has 80,000. Now, you go to the division blogs, the NFC East blog, they have like 20,000 followers. So clearly people are following the reporters, maybe not the regional sites as much, and that could be an issue. But as we've talked about before in the show, the ESPN regional, ESPN Dallas, they're not working. They're just not working. So, but if you go to ESPN proper, the mothership, if you will, they do have reporters who are getting followed. Maybe Cuban's just not following any of them.
No, that's a good point. It would be interesting, and nobody seemed to. I skimmed through some of the comments, and most of them just seemed to be stroking the article.
Right.
No one seemed to challenge him on that one and say, "Well, you know, who exactly are you speaking of?" Because like when I think Twitter and I think ESPN, the first one I think is Schefter, because I think that he's the probably the best sort of breaking news guy they've got. I think he's the guy that gets the best information, and so that shows if people look to you and say, I know that you're going to get me the information first. You're going to get to me fast. Well, I'm going to follow you. And boom, 500,000 followers, like you said. So it's a matter of how much do people trust those people? How much do they trust their opinion and say, you're going to give me the information I need right away? Like, you know, say with NBA, Broussard, he's a guy that I think, okay, he's going to break some news for me. He's got over 100,000. So it's a matter of people looking at that feed and saying, I want to follow people who are going to get me the information I need right away.
Right.
And those people are doing okay. Mort, I'm sure Mort's got tons of people.
Yeah, 280,000, I said. Now, look, Cuban has 388,000 followers. So he has the weight to say this because there are very few ESPN people who have more than him. But let's go through a couple. And I want to use this as a point. As you said, Schefter, he has 529,000 followers. Jay Glazer, as a comparison, has 111,000. Still an amazing number of people following him, but one-fifth of what Schefter has. Jason LaCanfora, who has Adam Schefter's old job at the NFL Network, has 65,000. So whatever Schefter's been able to do, Glazer to some extent, and LaCanfora to a huge extent, has not been able to capitalize upon. So it's the exact opposite of what Cuban's saying. I just don't think that Cuban follows the NFL guys. Even baseball. If you look at the baseball guys, Keith Law has 347,000 followers.
Wow.
Buster only has 156,000. Jason the Stark, 65,000. And then it drops off a little bit, and I didn't get everyone on this list. Jerry Krasnick has 27,000, and Tim Kirkchen has only 18,000, but he never tweets and doesn't follow anyone. You look at, J.A. Adande. I didn't mention him. He's a basketball guy, although I think more of a general columnist at this point. 131,000. Stephen A. Smith, who's back in the ESPN fold doing radio and as a columnist, 134,000. That guy can break news. You look at the ESPN feed itself, 1.1 million followers. SportsCenter has 770,000. Sports Nation, 845. These are all places that can break news, that will report news that has been broken on their feeds and send it back to the mothership. So they have a system. And look, I'm not being an apologist for ESPN. I just think the Cuban's wrong. Because
it all depends on what your goal is with Twitter. I mean, if ESPN made it a priority and said, okay, we want to get your followers up, we want to make sure that everyone's looking at you, then, like you said, they would take the SportsCenter Twitter feed that's got over a million people, and they would start saying, hey, they would do follow Fridays. They would do follow Mondays, for crying out loud. Just say, hey, you want news? Do this. They would use that. I just don't think that's necessarily the goal they need. I don't think they feel they need to push people. So it's not a failed experiment if you're not using the experiment. It's not failed if that's not your plan. And he's acting like, oh, my God, they're not following my plan. and doing what they need to do to get their Twitter, you know, followers up on their reporter. No, that's just not what they're into doing. And people will find those people if they want, if the reporters, if they want to. And if ESPN wanted them to have followers, trust me, they would have them.
I mean, look, does Pat Forty want more than 64,000 people? Does Mark Schlabaugh, who's a great reporter for college sports, does he want more than 20,000 followers? Certainly. Certainly they'd all want 200,000 followers. You know, I've talked to Wingo 100 times, and every single time he's on the show or off the show, he says, I don't even know how I got that. I think I ended up on some Twitter.com list of people who are worth following, and all of a sudden the next day I ended up with 400,000 followers. So nobody really knows how you get these followers, and I don't think Cuban really knows. He's just a good, dynamic personality, and people flock to him. Same with Simmons. But there is a weird – I mean, you're right. There are ways for ESPN, but we've talked with Rob King before on the show, and I think the one thing you credit with Rob King with is he likes – you have to be real in the social space. You have to be organic. And as much as those are buzzwords, it's the truth. You can't force it down people's throats because they won't pay attention. Tim Kirkchian has 17,000 followers because he's not following anyone else, because he barely ever tweets. To me, it's a little weird that Jason Stark only has 65,000. You know, that's a little strange because he's a very dynamic tweeter. He gives great information. He's a great writer. Maybe, I mean, I'm surprised he doesn't have 100,000 people just in Philadelphia. So some of them are just sort of outliers. They don't make sense. And then you have Jay Billis with 96,000 people. He joined Twitter like a month ago. Erin Andrews, you know, started less than a year ago. She has 400,000 people. Now a lot of that's Dancing with the Stars. But anyway, I can keep going. The point is, I don't think Cuban's right. So,
no, I do not think they have a quote-unquote.
Do you have anything else to say?
Yeah, I mean, real quick. We talk TV, obviously, a lot. We like various AMC shows. And they debuted a new program last night.
Don't spoil it.
No, I'm just going to say The Killing, and it was good. It's one of those slow burn shows, so it could lose some people, but I like those shows. And if I know that we're talking about a 13-episode arc and it's a mystery, I'm cool with that. And it took about a half an hour, you know, and it's very Twin Peaks-esque in that it's dreary and it's Seattle and there's a murder involved. So for that reason, if anyone's a fan of that show, they'll sort of reminiscent of that. But, no, it has good potential, and after 2 hours, it had me hooked in. So if you like that kind of a mystery and you're willing to sort of commit yourself and not look for an immediate release from a show, then I would recommend it. I'm sure it'll be replayed many times.
It's been on like all day on AMC. I actually taped it last night in like the very early parts of the morning, and we'll plan to watch that today. DL on the DLpodcast.com is the email address. You can see the site, see the show rather, at presscoverage.us or at On the DL Podcast. Counting down. Jay Busby and Shane Bacon are going to be on this week, maybe even tomorrow if I can get that together today, to talk some Masters. I can't believe it's Masters week already. But I think tomorrow we'll probably recap the national championship game and pick apart one shining moment. That's going to be the whole show. Talk to everybody tomorrow.